I mean, I think if we discover life on Mars, it doesn't matter even if we don't go there as humans, it's going to change the way we perceive ourselves hugely.
Hey folks, we're about to kick off with this week's podcast. Before we kick it off, here's a nice little philosophy moment with my pal, Andre King Comedy. Enjoy.
Whoa, this is my Kiwi life.
No matter how bad your day has been, try to remember, it could still get much worse.
Hello and welcome to an all new episode of the My Kiwi Life podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. If you're new to the show, Will Fleming is my name. Who am I? That's a good question. I'm 30-something, so I've got the job, I've got the family, got the kids. Up to this point, I've been working hard trying to get here, and now I'm like, what's next? You know, I've got there, now what? And so here's the thing, I think there's other people out there like me, maybe you, maybe some of the listeners who tune in every week. We're all just kind of like cruising along on this earth together, just kind of forgetting how awesome it is because we're so busy with bills. We're so busy with life. So My Kiwi Life is a podcast where I get awesome guests to come into the Podcast New Zealand studio, and we just sit down and we just talk about life. And it's that simple. Out of this comes awesome conversations about, you know, what you do in tough situations, you know, DIY tips and tricks to kind of getting it right. And it's not that I'm going in there with these agendas, but that's what I'm coming out with, which is cool, which is encouraging. I'm getting lots of feedback online. People are liking the podcast. And this is cool. This is where it needs to be, folks. So once again, if you're new to the show, thank you. You're home. You've found a place for you, another person like you. Random host Will, who by day has a normal job, has a family, and by night moonlights as a podcaster, hopefully one day to be a full-time podcaster. That'd be awesome. Okay, so let's jump into this week's guest. As you know, we try and expand our minds a little bit on My Kiwi Life, and today's no different. My guest this week is Professor Steve Poynting. Now, he's a cool dude. Here's how he got into science. Science was his way out of being bullied. And when he told me that, I was just like, whoa, hold the phone. Because it makes you think of all the tough things in your childhood and the things you get into after. And are they a way to get you out? What's the way in? This is just all intense stuff, but it's cool stuff. And Steve sits down with me. He's a professor that looks for life on other planets. He explores, you know, like water on Mars. He worked on missions with NASA. It's intense stuff. But here's the thing, he's just a normal dude, and I forget that sometimes. I forget that these, you know, astronauts, well, he's not an astronaut, but he's riding with astronauts. He's not riding with, he's kind of like cruising. Look, you know what I mean. He's involved with these elite group of people, but underneath that, he's just a cool dude. He's got issues, he's got problems, and he shares some of those. So Steve joins me on the podcast today, and we have a cool chat. Ironically, not all about space. I thought we were going to come in and nerd out on some planets. We ended up talking about human stuff, which is weird, which is cool in a way. Anyway, so Steve joins me. He's the man. Love you, Steve. Couple thank yous. Paul Spain and the crew from Podcasts New Zealand. Doing some cool stuff there, doing some very cool stuff. Podcasts about technology, entertainment, so many more pods coming. Currently, you know, this is all up in it. New Zealand is slowly getting there, and this is awesome to be part of this, hopefully, podcast wave. Speaking of podcast waves, Crawford, thank you, man. I really am thankful for all the work you put in for My Kiwi Life. Awesome. Here we go with Steve Poynting, this week's guest on My Kiwi Life. Rate, subscribe, share, mykiwilife.com, all that stuff.
My Kiwi Life, let's play the game of life today. My Kiwi Life, the ups and downs we live each day. This is my Kiwi Life. Oh, this is my Kiwi Life.
Steve, you're the second professor I've ever had in this room. I feel like the first professor was good. He reminded me that it's okay to be lazy. This is your colleague, Grant.
Oh, Grant Schofield, yes.
Yeah, he told me he was a lazy bugger.
Oh, that's not true. He's very self-deprecating. He actually works pretty hard.
Yeah. That's the thing is that I imagine to become a professor, you have to put in some hours.
Well, yeah, you do. I mean, to get to the top of your game in any field, you have to. I mean, it doesn't happen by accident. I don't think there are any shortcuts. But yeah, I mean, to become a professor, you really have to also perform in multiple areas. And this is where academia is not perhaps the, in quotes, easy job it used to be. You have to obviously be a competent teacher to teach and educate students, but you also have to be excellent in research. And on top of all that, you may also have numerous admin and management roles. So it's quite a challenging job, yes.
And the other interesting thing, and this is the last time I'll bring up Grant because this is your podcast, is that I said to him, I said, Grant, you are a lucky bugger to be, your field is fat, you know, and how it's good for us. I said, imagine if you were the guy who found out ant poo is really good for wrinkles, you know. I mean, that would actually be quite a good one. Let's say ant poo was good for slowing down nail growth. I think you'll have a tough time trying to find funding. And the same goes for you. To look for life on other planets is what I think humans are looking for, you know. It might not be the only question, but I'm sure there's a time growing up, I'm sure I had it too, where I'm like, you know, what else is out there? There must be something. And it's good that you are in that field. So I think you and Grant are both lucky.
Well, listen, I'll tell you a funny story, and I swear this is true, but the first science experiment I ever did was actually on poo. I think I was around 11 or 12. I just started high school back in the UK, and we were asked to do something. And I lived in the countryside, and I was fascinated by all the mushrooms and fungi that grew on cow poop. And so actually my first ever experience with science was looking at fungus on poop.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. Who would have known, eh, that boy looking at poo would go on to be looking for life. So here's the thing. I do a little bit of internet stalking / research on you, and I see that you're saying you're looking for life. But what does that mean to the average person like me? Are you looking for aliens? Are you looking for something in between?
Yeah, it's a good point. Hey, look, I think the field that I'm in, just to clarify, is that I'm fascinated by the notion of whether life may or may not exist on other planets. And what I've tried to do in my career over the past two decades is to try and find out whether there's any scientific evidence to support the idea that life could exist, specifically on the surface of Mars. But what I'm not really looking for are little green men or women or little green people, I should probably more politically correctly say. No, it's really about exploring what we call the extremes of life. You know, so the first question I guess I want to answer is whether or not life exists elsewhere. And if there is that whole second genesis, you know, that multiple origin of life, then it brings up these amazing questions. And this is where I think my science becomes very exciting, because it takes science out of the realm of just science and into the realms of philosophy and faith and spirituality. And for me, you know, those are all issues that have been quite important to me throughout my life. So I'm still very enthusiastic about what I do for a living.
Yeah. And I was telling you before we started recording that I'm certainly at a point in my life where I'm looking for something. I don't know what it is, but I figure doing this will help me. Talking to people who are also searching in different areas for different things must be healthy. There must be a reason why I'm out there looking. For you, was there that growing up? Were you looking for something?
I can't say that I was really looking for something. I mean, my sort of segue into science from education was really just a means of escape. You know, as we've discussed, you know, I had a fairly unpleasant childhood, and I just wanted something that didn't involve having to interact with other people. So I used to go off and, you know, study animals and plants because they didn't pick on me. So well, most of them got bitten a few times. But no, science, it was all about, for me in my early career, it was about a fascination with the world around me. And then gradually that evolved into what I do now. And that is, you know, a more broader interest in, you know, where do we come from? You know, what's our purpose? Where are we going? You know, what's the future for humanity?
So, yeah. And I wonder, have you found answers like what the future is for humanity? Because it freaks me out to think that, you know, I'm not a and I need to be careful that I don't make myself sound terrible. I would say I'm of average intelligence. You know what I mean? I can function well in society. I can make friends. I can stay married. I can be happy. But I know there's something not quite right with the way the earth is. So it makes me think for people like yourself who their career is to study, to look, to observe. Is it frustrating for you to see how the world is? I don't know if that's really a question.
Well, firstly, I think all the symptoms you've described are of someone of very above average intelligence. So I think you're doing yourself down there a little bit.
Sorry.
But yeah, you know, it's interesting. My broad field is environmental science. I study organisms in their environment, and most environmental scientists do tend to be gloom mongers. You know, they're always on about climate change and pollution. And sure, these are major issues, and they're life-changing issues, if not for this generation, then the next. But I do think that as a scientist, we also have a kind of a duty to not just be an advocate for what we feel about something, but to also present a balanced view. And I think it's quite clear that humans are the dominant form of life on this planet. And so it's really not necessary, in my view, to constantly have a negative outlook on our impact on the planet. You know, humans are great organisms of necessity. You know, in times of war and strife, we've always found a solution. And my belief is that no matter what nature or humans throw at us, that we will find a solution. So I tend to be optimistic.
I love that because it's very comforting for me. But, you know,
I can't guarantee it's true, though, Will.
I'll just edit that bit out and it'll make you sound like... No, it's interesting because every now and then I will wonder, are we on the right path? And I think I've already said that, but... you know, just sitting down with you and sitting down with others, I feel like that's the right path. Just doing what we don't do every day. You know, what we don't do every day is to say hello to people properly, is to look at them in the eye. You know, we might do it online or in another way, but to sit and talk with someone that you don't know, I'm sure there was a time where that was very important in humanity.
I tend to agree with you, and I wonder whether in part whether that's due to the sheer number of people there are these days. You know, a lot of us live in cities, and cities do tend to breed a very impersonal sort of culture, don't they? You know, as you say, the bigger the city, the more, you know, bumping and swearing you hear in the street. Yeah. So, yeah, I agree with that. And I also think that it's probably fair to say that we are, as humanity, losing our moral compass slightly.
Mm.
And so certainly, I believe that, yeah, there's room for improvement, let's say.
Yeah. If I can jump back a little bit and then we'll come forward, we'll jump around in time a wee bit. What did 5-year-old Steve want to be as a kid? Was a scientist always the goal?
Yeah, you know, it's quite strange. You know, when I asked my son what he wanted to be, at age 5 he wanted to be an astronaut. Then it was, I think, a fireman, and now he wants to go and work at Weta Studios. But for me, my earliest memories are of simply being in awe of nature. And I know it sounds really cliched and silly, but I used to, when I close my eyes now, I can still remember the riverbanks, and I remember looking at kingfishers especially and looking at them catch their prey and looking at all the creepy crawlies. And what really got me interested in science was the closer I looked at something. You know, when I laid on the ground and looked in the grass, I could see little beetles. And then if you looked at the beetles carefully, some of them had, you know, fungus growing on them. And it was the ever diminishing scale of things, but increasing complexity at the same time. And I loved that.
Yeah. Mm. And do you think, Steve, that, and I say it with all respect, is science becoming cool? You know, you see movies like The Martian. We've recently seen NASA saying water on Mars. I'd love, you know, to talk about that because I watched your TED talk and you were kind of hinting at something like that, or I'd seen something on YouTube where I'm pretty sure you already said there was water on there, but this is before NASA said. So I thought, well, maybe they called Steve.
Oh, yeah, it's all down to me. No, NASA, if you're listening, that's not true. No, what I do like to think I'm fairly good at is sort of deconvoluting very scientific and jargony type, you know, outputs and making them publicly accessible. So maybe the issue there is that I was perhaps one of the first to make this sort of information available in a way that was palatable to people who are not scientists like myself. And it's interesting, you know, that the traditional concept of a scientist, you know, with a beard and a pipe and, you know, a cardigan with patches on, has really changed. I mean, to the extent now that in New Zealand, you know, we now have, you know, more females than males entering science.
And wow,
it's
cool.
A wonderful thing. I, you know, it's very refreshing for me to be in a, certainly in my workplace, in a gender balanced workplace. I think there's huge benefits to that for everyone. Yeah. And science, I think is, I don't think it's always, to answer your question, I don't think science has always been cool because of the stereotypes.
Right.
But having said that, when one looks back through popular fiction, there has often been a scientific hero. You know, even when you go pre-television back to H.G. Wells and you know, sort of literature of the Victorian era, there were still scientists who were the you know, protagonists. So maybe science has always been cool, but just quietly cool.
I want it to be that someone like you is the Kim Kardashian, you know, that
the kids
growing up want to have a butt like Steve. But you know, that's the interesting thing is I saw a are you a Game of Thrones fan?
Oh yes.
And Joffrey, is it?
Yes.
And it's, you know, you look at him and you think, man, he's a meanie. And then I watched an interview with him on YouTube and he was talking about celebrity and what it means, and that, and I might be butchering this, but I'll do my best to explain it. He was saying that in the old days, a celebrity was someone who was good at something. And what would happen is everyone would come around that person and they would watch what he would do or she would do. So if you were the best nail maker, we'd all gather around and watch you make that nail. But the interesting thing they found was, so for example, I'm the best nail maker, I'm doing two whacks on the nail, and then for some reason, it just feels right for me to wipe my brow. People would watch that. They would then go back to their own towns, do the two nail bash and the brow, thinking that's the way you do it. And he said that's the problem with society today, is that we watch a Justin Bieber and we think he's cool because he can sing, but we think we also have to replicate the silly behavior outside in normal life. And so we're, I don't really know what I'm trying to say. I guess it's that it's a little bit silly how we follow people like Bieber and all of those people who I don't particularly think – I think they're good at what they do, but they shouldn't be the celebrities. It should be people like yourself who actually are trying to find, I don't know, a different way of thinking.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I actually saw the Justin Bieber interview with Paul Henry last week, and I felt that he, for a very young man, he was remarkably balanced and showed incredible maturity and upfrontness about, you know, what happened in his recent past. And I couldn't help but be quite impressed with him. But yeah, it's interesting. You know, I'm a big sports fan, and as a younger man, I was really into soccer. And since moving to New Zealand, I'm a huge, as you can tell by my t-shirt, a huge NRL fan, just because there is so much more integrity in rugby league than there is in soccer. You know, I played a lot of soccer, but not once in any game I played did anyone fake injury and roll around on the floor like a, you know,
right?
Like a ballet dancer. So yeah, it was, you know, I think you're right. You know, role models today can get away with behavior that is unseemly if they're good at one thing. But I think any role model who's the whole real deal is probably, yeah, quite hard to find.
Yeah. Well, I hope it's like this whole podcasting thing where it's more interesting now for us to just talk than to be at 7 minutes in, we're going to move over to another topic. You know what I mean? We're just having this conversation. I would like to think that folks out there listening feel like they're part of the conversation, that what we're talking about sparks a thought in their mind and so on. So, okay. I just had this little thought in my mind, so I'll go back to it, because we kind of glanced over water on Mars, and I had a big note here to talk about that. I'm sure everyone's kind of come to you with the same theme to talk about, but do you remember where you were when you heard, when NASA announced that it was confirmed?
Well, it's been a bit of a, forgive the pun, a trickle really for me, because the evidence for water on Mars has been kind of filtering through over the last 10, 15 years or so. And, you know, NASA has had a very distinct goal of what they call find the water, because we know that life absolutely requires water. So if there's no water, you can't find life, and it's easier to find water than little microbes. So, you know, finding minerals that were could only be formed, you know, under wet conditions was one of the first lines of evidence. But more recently, and especially this year, with these dramatic discoveries of evidence for huge lakes that persisted probably for very long time periods up there, has been, yeah, it's been amazing. As to where I was, probably in front of my computer at work. You know, yeah. I do tend to spend rather too much time at work. So, yeah, probably with a little Mac symbol glaring at me.
Nice. So just like me then, just mm-hmm. getting through their day and seeing something else. Because you worked at NASA, so I thought that they would have sent you a special little message through saying, hey, man, we did it. We found it.
Well, I still work with people at NASA, and I'm involved in a project which is evaluating the sort of next generation of Mars rovers. And these rovers go, these prototypes go out to the Atacama Desert. And so I'm involved in a project which is evaluating how the drill tailings that they recover could be assessed for signs of life. And so I'm very fortunate and very honored to still be part of their astrobiology program, astrobiology being the whole study of the search for life elsewhere. Scientists are remarkably well linked in these days, not only in social media, which is a necessity now, but also the scientific community has this incredible network of communication in terms of releasing scientific findings and letting people know what they're doing. So it's fairly instantaneous, to be honest with you.
And you know, in my mind, we kind of hinted at it before, talking about what made science not cool was the thought of these grumpy old, you know, people in white jackets. And what I think they must have wanted to, you know, at a time where someone said the Earth is flat, they would have fought for that, right? That would have been their theory, and they were sticking to it. And do you get a sense that scientists today are, if someone proves them wrong, they're able to move on from that? Or is there still a hint of, man, I've spent 20 years studying this, and now you're telling me my research is not legit?
Look, there are many answers to that. Scientists of old, there were some – scientists have always probably had to be slightly radical, good scientists. But the problem now is that science as a career has become very mainstream. Right. And, you know, there are very good scientists. There are, you know, average scientists, and there are unfortunately some bad scientists. I think the mark of a good scientist is someone who is willing to be a risk taker. You have to be willing to ask the big questions. And if you're going to do that, you are on occasion going to fail. It's just a fact of life, and you will be wrong. But the willingness to do that and to learn from it and move forward and make sure that as a scientific community, you all get something out of it. I think that's the mark of a good scientist. It's just unfortunate that the nature of the career structure of science these days is such that very often, you know, the political nature of the job sometimes overshadows the scientific drivers of the job.
Yeah. Mm. Well, it's deep, isn't it? I mean, so many factors to consider. Have you seen the movie The Martian?
No, that's on our to-do list this week. Okay. Yeah,
it's interesting because, you know, even that coming out and, you know, Prometheus and all these space movies, I mean, science fiction has been obviously well established, but I feel like, you know, you have the movies now where the cool guys are the scientists.
I think you're right, and certainly it seems to me, and I may be wrong on this, maybe it's just, you know, my patterns of behavior, but it seems there are a lot more science-based movies. And something that just, you know, sort of segueing off from that a bit, something that's always fascinated me is how science fiction and science reality are actually really closely linked. You know, simple examples like the tricorder in Star Trek. You know, medical technologists have been trying for ages to develop one, which was inspired by Star Trek.
And,
you know, rockets to the moon were first proposed in science fiction literature way before we had rocketry. So the it's not always the case that science inspires science fiction or vice versa. I think the two necessarily feed off each other because scientific innovation requires that light bulb that creates a thought out of the box. And maybe that's essentially science fiction. Yeah. And then it's the scientist's job to translate that into science reality.
It made me think of, I saw an interview with, and I'll butcher his name, but I'll try it anyway. Is it Michio Kaku? I think he's a Hawaiian. He's like supposed to be today's version of Einstein. Anyway, I'll send you a link. And he was talking about 2001, the Stanley Kubrick film. And apparently Stanley Kubrick went to the leading scientists of the day and said, look, what's the most likely scenario about an alien making contact? And he said, well, just pretty much how it was in the film, they'll leave a clue for you, which was the monolith, and when you're smart enough to get there, they'll give you the next clue, and so on and so on. And I just thought, oh, well, maybe it all intertwines, and on a deeper level, we're all kind of connecting. But yeah, no, it's interesting, and I'm not sure, again, what I believe, but I figure that if I keep asking these kind of questions to people like yourself, I don't know, maybe I will never find an answer, but maybe that's the point of it.
Well, yeah, but I agree with you completely. And you know what's really interesting is, you know, I had a fairly religious upbringing and yet have become a scientist, and I still have respect for you know, both sides of the coin there. But I'm really fascinated by the notion of whether or not there's almost like a cosmic imperative to us being here. You know, whether humanity has a destiny or not. And I don't have an answer, you know, and I'm not a nutcase, you know. But I'm very intrigued by the idea of whether, for example, developing interstellar capabilities is actually as predictable for humanity as inventing the steam engine was.
Right.
You know, because we know that Earth has a finite lifespan. And although it's perhaps not a fact that's widely known, you know, the Earth's not going to be habitable in a billion years. And although a billion years is very hard to envisage, I don't like the idea of admitting that, you know, my great, 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 many times grandchildren won't have a planet to live on. So, yeah, I think it actually is very thought-provoking. And I think it's something that probably people over, you know, a wine or three have probably debated, you know, all over the world.
Well, it makes you wonder if people have come up with the answer and they think it's too silly and moved on or, yeah, I don't know. Because there's a fine line, eh, Steve, where you can easily make things sound silly, but well, I guess what I mean by that is we can get into a conversation where all of a sudden someone's like, oh, that's ridiculous, the stuff you're talking about.
Yeah, and I think with the quest for life on other planets, it's very easy to cross that line. And I think a lot of scientists and sort of pseudo-celebrity scientists have made that mistake. They've over-sensationalized trivial findings, and they've implied things that are way beyond the limits of data they may have presented. So yeah, I agree. It's one of those fields where I've always been very cautious. And I remember years ago when I was living in Hong Kong and started to really get interested in this field, I proposed to my then boss that, you know, I'd like to offer a student course on this just to, you know, share the ideas. And I presented what I thought was a very balanced outline for this, and they just said, you're joking.
You know? Right?
Eventually they caved in and it became the most popular course in the university, actually.
Yeah,
but
well, that's the thing.
But that's beside the point. I think it takes time to break down barriers and to erode what is often probably suspicion sometimes of new ideas.
Mm. Do you ever think about where artificial intelligence will mix in with us, and maybe that, here's what I'm kind of saying, you know, like life comes in all types of forms. Mm. Maybe a step in our evolution as people or humans is not kind of the living, but this artificial intelligence which will fuse with us. I'd like to think that maybe we could act like birds, you know, that bird turns left, the other ones know he's going to turn left, or he or she, and they all work in unison. And I my sense is we don't, you know, apart from the motorway where, if you live in Auckland, you're probably not driving that fast because it's always traffic jammed. But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting for me.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that there are two ways to look at this. So that, you know, the future view of humans as these sort of vaguely cyborg-like creatures is something that really shocks and frightens me. I can't think of anything worse than having sort of robot arms and being part machine. Whereas other people find it fascinating. Mm. I think what's much more likely is that, and especially given our sort of rapidly advancing knowledge about our genetics, is that we'll be able to tailor-make our bodies to adapt to new situations. And I certainly think it's within our lifetime that we'll see, you know, subtle changes in our physiology and probably our mental capacity as well as a result of that.
Well, I guess if you look just at, you know, and again, this is not based on any research, it's just me talking dribble, but, you know, say 500 years ago, if they looked at the things you could do today, that would just be amazing, right? Like an antibiotic that could fix your cough, for example, or, you know, anything to things we take for granted, you know, our watches, our phones, that it can connect to space and back. And if a message doesn't go through straight away, we get annoyed because we're so used to this, you know, this instant. But I forget, and I have to remind myself, when I send you a text, it'll go to space and then come back down. Just mind-blowing. And I think we don't all think about it enough, but we should acknowledge that we live in a pretty impressive time, you know? It just happens that we focus sometimes on the negatives.
Yeah, and I mean, I certainly see it with the younger generation, you know, even of my son's age, they are so at home with mobile technology and computers and the internet. And they kind of understand the basics, you know, as you said, that, you know, signals are bounced off satellites. But I wonder just how many people understand exactly how these things work. And I think, you know, if everything had to be reset with human society and we had to sort of start building again, it's unlikely, you know, there's a famous saying that, you know, there's no one person on the earth that knows how to make a pencil from scratch.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's quite frightening that we've become so highly specialized, no matter what we do. And for me, I mean, my father was a carpenter, and I always get remarkable satisfaction. I'm not a very good carpenter myself, but I love doing DIY. And recently, a friend of mine and myself, we built a fence, and it was the most satisfying day I'd spent for many years, you know. And so I think it's important to keep that balance in your life and keep a connection with things that are outwardly mundane, but actually it can be fulfilling. Like, you know, when I cut the grass, I always take the grass collecting box off and I get my son to rake the grass up because it's a bonding thing and it's also exercise. And, you know, of course, I'm sure my neighbors think I'm completely balmy, but surely to me, that's much more sane and sensible than going to a gym and going round and round but going nowhere on a machine. So
Well, it's as if you think about it, and it's until you start breaking the, you know, how society works down, where, you know, you will drive to the gym to go for a walk on the machine.
Yes.
You know, and if you think about like how we go shopping and we just go for food, that's all stacked there nicely. And, you know, when you're saying if we have to push the reset button, the problem is we all look the part, but could we go out and find food? Could we go out and find fresh water to if there's nothing, you know, I'm sure we could. Could you build a fire if you couldn't find your matches or lighter? And I don't know. I struggle with it because I think maybe that is evolution working, that we should let things go. You know, if you keep everything on your computer, it's going to get too full. So maybe we should, you know, purge some stuff. But it's a big price to pay, right? Because all that needs to happen is the lights go out and then...
Yeah. Oh, but no, I think you're right. I mean, I think the only way society moves forward is by, as you say, quite rightly, letting go of some things in order to adopt new things. And I mean, I don't suppose either you or I could sort of hunt a mammoth or something if it hove into view, but... Yeah, very interesting point. I guess it's contradicting what I just said about raking the grass, but I guess what I'm trying to get at in some ways is I like the idea, even if I don't always do it in practice, of blending practicality in my life with my real-life day job, which by and large involves fairly abstract thought. So, maybe there's, you know, a lesson for me there.
Well, it's a lesson for everyone, you know. Like, I mean, for me, I certainly know at times I can be too focused on what's happening next, you know, whereas looking in the now is probably useful, but a very hard thing for our poor minds, which are going in overdrive. We're trying to keep up. We're trying to stay inspired. And the problem is there's always the person you want to be and what you think you should be, and society's pushing that on you, and just trying to find that balance. It's tricky. And it's just nice, I think, to, you know, talk like we are. I feel like
I'm finding it quite cathartic, actually.
Yeah,
I'm enjoying it. But you know, what is interesting is I think, and I'm probably more guilty than anyone about this, is, you know, never being satisfied with your lot.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's part of what characterizes my drive to always try and improve myself as a scientist. But I think we'd all be happier if we could be more acceptive of who we are. You know, we're all different, and there does seem a little bit too much pressure on occasion to conform to certain ideals and certain behaviors as well. And, you know, I do think, as I say, I can't claim to be good at this. I wish I was, because I'd be a lot happier. But I wish I could be happier with who I am, you know, rather than constantly worrying about, you know, oh, is that last pie too much or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, no, it's a, and it means so much to me, actually, that you will say that, because if I'm listening to this, that's what I want to hear. You know, I like the fact that we're all in it together in a strange way, and that we've got to wake up tomorrow. We've got to do the best we can, I guess. And that's the other thing, is it just doesn't stop. So that's okay. I'm okay with that. I know that today might be not so good, but tomorrow I get another shot at it. And so, we're pretty lucky, actually. So
I think we're all very lucky. I mean, I think living in this beautiful country, which is mine by adoption, but, you know, I love it all the same. You know, we all of us, you know, even if we're not enjoying particularly good times, we're all blessed to live here. And I think, you know, you sometimes need a reality check. You know, we all get jealous of someone who's got a nice car or a bigger house or whatever, or, you know, whatever. But, yeah, it's very important, I think, to find satisfaction at whatever level with what you do have in life.
It's interesting for me, Steve, because I had notes to talk about life on other planets, what's happening, and we're actually talking about our lives
about
as
life.
People.
Yeah.
And that just proves to me that I think we need to do a bit more of that. Just go find that person and have a bit of a have a yarn, have a talk, because it's the things we think we're looking for, maybe we're not. It's actually just a bit of a self-reflection, which for some reason we don't really get enough of. Maybe that's social media. Maybe we think we do when we take the picture of our dinner, but it's not the same as actually remembering back.
I actually think the two things are linked. I mean, I think contemplating life elsewhere, as I said, you know, involves thinking very deeply about who we are and, you know, where we've come from and where we're going. And so I think it's quite natural for a conversation to evolve into something like this. And just thinking back to conversations I've had with friends and colleagues and family, even on this issue, almost invariably they've drifted into sort of meaning of life type conversations. So yeah, I think you've probably got it spot on.
You said something that captured my imagination a bit. It was about this idea, and apologies if I get it wrong, that if we, was it the Aztecs or something, where you said life came in and the native people there changed forever. They would never be the same again.
Yeah.
And you asked us to look at ourselves to say, if we did meet the little green men, would we do the same to them? You know, would we make it so that they would change forever? And it makes me think about Mars and water, and what does that mean? I mean, it makes me think that, are we okay going to visit? Will we do that to Mars? Will we change it so it can never be the same again?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I think if we discover life on Mars, it doesn't matter even if we don't go there as humans, it's going to change the way we perceive ourselves hugely. And so I think it's something that will touch everyone on the planet, even if we don't all go there. But the analogy that you're referring to about the Aztecs was the story of Cortez, the Spanish explorer. So in the 1500s, he landed there and, you know, he marveled at the culture and thought they were fantastic, very advanced. But of course, his lust for gold got the better of him. And what happened was, despite taking all their gold and wiping most of them out through introduced diseases, the real tragedy there was that within about one or two generations, they had ceased to exist because genetically they'd been outbred through forced interbreeding, and or they died. And that, to me, is a question we need to ask ourselves if and when signs of intelligent life on other planets comes to pass. Because it sounds very far-fetched, but, you know, it's a probability game. You know, that there are billions of planets out there that could sustain life. And so chances are, maybe not in our lifetimes, but sooner or later, maybe in 1,000 years, maybe in 1,000,000 years, I suspect that some sort of contact with life that's not just slimy microbial life might happen. And I guess then the question does become, you know, do we sort of go with sort of olive branches and say, oh, hi, you know, we're your neighbors?
Yeah.
Or do you assume, as humans tend to do all the time, you know, that you need to arm yourself to the teeth and risk, you know, getting their backs up, if they have backs, that is. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you like to think that as we progress as humanity, we will become, you know, as an overall species, we'll become more enlightened. So as and when that does happen, I would like to think that it will be a pleasant experience rather than getting wiped out.
Yeah, it's interesting, because if I really ask myself point blank, what would we do? I'm pretty sure humans wouldn't make the right call. We'd make ourselves, I'm sure we'd see it as a threat, but maybe that's just too, maybe that's me getting that wrong.
Yeah. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, the one thing that I've always found very interesting, and this actually is another interesting tie back to science fiction as well, is that in most science fiction movies, the planet Earth has a single space air force or a single military. And it would be very satisfying, I think, if there was ever contact with an alien civilization. And of course, this is a what if. You know, I've got no evidence whatsoever that this will happen. But it would be nice to think that we could, if not instantly, that certainly over a short period of time, realize that despite our differences in color and size and culture and race, that we are all pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at, I always say to people, look how different our dogs are. You know, there's big dogs, small dogs, hairy dogs, whatever. Yeah. They're so much more different than every human on the planet. Yet, you know, we humans can't seem to get on. It's absolutely bizarre.
And I don't know why that is. If I can understand life that, for example, fat tastes nice. There's a reason for that. I understand why sex feels good, because surely that makes sense, you know, that...
if it didn't, we'd all die out.
Exactly. So the bit that confuses me is things like, you know, too much sugar. Your body thinks it's doing the right thing, but there must be like a life hack or something that intercepts. And maybe that's the bit where we're getting it wrong as humans, you know? We think we're going down the right path, but we're actually filling our body with sugar. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, without going back into the food debate, but I tend to agree. I mean, certainly there are some things that you can tangibly relate back to our existence as a simpler people. So, you know, sweet things were sparse, and so when they were around,
it
made sense to gorge on them. But there is also, and this is something that comes from my field of genetics, that there is an awful lot of information in the media about the genetic basis for this and that, which I find is very, very spuriously supported by the science. And the science is in brackets for a lot of these studies. You know, you very often read things as a scientist and then go and find the scientific paper that backs it up, supposedly, and it's not very rigorous.
Yeah.
And I think that it's rather depressing that genetics is being used as a crutch or an excuse by several groups to explain things that really are down to, you know, poor lifestyle choices or states letting certain people down, or society letting people down. And so I think science is a very powerful tool. You know, it has the power for incredible good, but in the wrong hands and if misconstrued, as the media is, you know, unfortunately it does tend to do, because they have a different objective. They're not being evil, but the media has an entertainment motive, whereas scientists, you know, have a motive to inform and to solve problems. I think there is a potential conflict there, and it's one that I've certainly noticed in the last decade or so has become more evident, because, you know, the search for sensational news, you know, has become more thirsty.
Well, the 24-hour news channel, you know, and the removal, even in New Zealand, the removal of more and more news and current affairs. That's an interesting situation, because we all kind of play a role in it as well if we choose to watch the Kardashians in prime time.
Oh, you know what I mean? Don't get me wrong. I love telly. Yeah. I love television. You know, I'll watch it all day if I could. And I adore New Zealand television too. I know people complain an awful lot about it, but we've got some great reality shows. We've got some great current affairs shows, or some no longer here, sadly, to talking about JC. But I think, you know, we are quite spoiled here. We're not exposed to, for example, I spent a lot of time in the US. We're not exposed to the a lot of the mindless television that, that occurs in other countries. So, yeah, you know, I think the New Zealand media is fairly well balanced.
Yeah,
and in terms of its job of entertaining people.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm sure there's a sense in New Zealand too that it must come from. What am I trying to say? If someone's too successful, Kiwis have a funny way of making them. How can I explain this better?
This tall poppy thing, right?
Yeah, and I see it in things like karaoke. When I was in the UK and in Germany, it's really cool to get up there and have a sing in those countries. But I have a sense here it's not that cool. You know, you get up there and you've got a good voice and someone's like, oh, look at that there, thinks they can sing.
Yeah. You know, it's funny for me that coming here as an immigrant who's always been in love with the place, you know, I've been coming here for many, many years through my work in Antarctica, I've always just worshipped Kiwis as cool, because Kiwis overseas as well, your exposure to Kiwis, it's always the cool dudes and the cool girls are always Kiwis. So I kind of see things differently, and maybe it's my rosy colored immigrant glasses, but I don't see as much evidence of this so-called tall poppy syndrome as I was expecting, because it certainly is played up a lot in the press.
Really?
And maybe I'm just not looking at the right information, I don't know. But I think we celebrate our heroes pretty well in New Zealand, especially, of course, you know, our sporting heroes. But I think one of the things I love about this country is the drive for success. You know, we're such a small country. You know, there's only, 4 million of us.
Yeah.
And yet we punch well above our weight in so many areas.
Yeah.
And it's something that being part of, I think, makes me feel very proud, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I can agree with that because, and I'm a weird guy, Steve. I'll break things down in my head. Like, I'll take things like we won the Rugby World Cup with a small population. Then we went to the Soccer World Cup and didn't lose against the previous World Cup's champions. So then I'll put it back on rugby and I'll think it would be like Namibia not losing against the All Blacks, and that would be amazing. And so I'll put those kind of things together and then I think, well, maybe we are lucky having a smaller population because, you know, a Richie McCaw has a better shot at getting seen as opposed to 500 really good Richies.
Yeah.
And then maybe half of them thinking, oh, bugger that, that's going to be too hard, I'll go in a different direction.
Well, I think there's a can-do attitude here, but yeah, you're also right. I mean, I was extremely lucky because I arrived here on the 2nd of January, so in the year I arrived, and literally 2 weeks later I met the Prime Minister.
Is that right?
And I was blown away, you know, and it, by the way, he's a really nice bloke as well. And it was just incredible to me. And I thought, well, you know, that's probably going to be the highlight of my stay in New Zealand. And lo and behold, a few months later, he came and opened my son's school. You know, the school had burnt down and got rebuilt. So I met him again and I thought, well, this is amazing. You know, I'm on my way here. But of course, it's not that unusual because, well, A, we have quite an affable Prime Minister. But I think figures that in other countries are not publicly accessible are accessible here.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Yeah.
It's something I hope we never lose as a country.
Yeah, I hope that's – and, you know, if I take it from my perspective – getting in touch with people like yourself to be a guest on the podcast, people that have been in TV that are busy people, that you can do it. There's the, you know, I can't imagine getting Tom Cruise, for example, one day.
But, do you want me to give him a call?
Yeah, if you could, that'd be awesome, Steve. Okay, mate. Well, we'll wrap up because I feel like we've kind of covered some areas. And it's good. What I'm hoping is someone listening might be thinking, jeepers, I like the sound of that. That's what I want to do with my life, you know, something like that. So what's some stuff that people who are listening, they've had a light bulb moment, they think I would like to follow somehow in your footsteps. Can they, what's some things they can do tomorrow, like jump online?
Well, yeah, you know, I think one of the things is, Don't be held back if the traditional education system has let you down a bit. I mean, I didn't do well when I was a youngster at school, but you know, I went back and succeeded. So, you know, if you haven't met all your goals through the regular school system, don't let that worry and don't let it hold you back. So certainly that's the first bit of advice. And the second would be, and I've seen this through working in the university system for decades. You know, don't follow the herd, you know, follow your dreams, because one thing I've always noticed is that anyone who's studying, whether it's formally in a university or on their own at home, if you're not studying something that you really care about, you're never really going to succeed. You know, you can't expect to get an A in something if you don't love it, because you won't put the hours in. So, you know, if everyone says, oh, you know, I want to study accountancy because I'll earn more money, but you passionately want to be a chemist or something, then study chemistry.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it will make you a happier person eventually.
Bloody good. I love it. I love it. Steve, how can people follow you if they want to keep in touch with stuff you're up to, research you're doing?
Hey, you know, I'm always happy to talk to people. So I'm on Twitter at Steve Poynting, STEVEPOINTING. I have a blog, which is pointingatscience.com. And I also have a website with the same name, pointingatscience.com, where you can look at my TV show, my radio show, and and just send me an email if you want to through there. I try to reply to everything.
Nice.
And, you know, if it takes a bit of time, forgive me, but I don't think I've ever not replied. So
cool. That's awesome. I'll try and ask this to every guest, but for me asking you, I think it means a bit more only because you are someone who's actively trying to do it to find I won't ruin the question. So what does life mean to you? What is life, Steve?
Well, I shall just say the first thing that came into my head, because that's usually the most honest answer, isn't it? It's life for me, honestly, is making sure that my family is happy and that I do the very best for them. And by family, you know, I've got a wider, funner definition of that, where, you know, it's not just my wife and my son, but the people around me that I care and love.
That's a perfect answer. You know, here's me thinking it would be something about you want to be the guy to go to Mars, but you bring it closer to home.
Hell, I do that too. But you know what? It's I think, you know, I'm a bit of a softie at heart, and I believe, although this is going to sound like a song title, you know, I think love is at the center of all of this, and whether it's a love for those around you or for your career, you know, I think most people, hopefully all people, put family first.
Cool, mate. Professor Steve Poynting, thank you for joining me on the podcast to talk. We went over a few topics today. We did a bit of life. We did a bit of life on other planets. We looked at our own lives.
Yeah, life, the universe, and everything, right?
Steve, thanks again, mate.
My pleasure.
Well, folks, that's the end of this week's episode, but have no fear. My Kiwi Life will be back next week with an all-new episode talking life, full stop. That's pretty cool. We'll just go in with the agenda of life. And if we come out with some goodness, some good stuff, thumbs up, team. We're doing all right, okay? We're doing all right. Okay, thank yous to Paul Spain from Podcast New Zealand. Jump online now to see all the podcasts that New Zealand have to offer. We've got podcasts on technology. We've got podcasts on entertainment. I'm sure there's podcasts on cars. There's podcasts on life. Paul's got it covered. So jump online right now, podcasts.co.nz. Thank you to Crawford for jumping in the studio with me, for helping me out. Thank you to my lovely wife for giving me time to do this. I know, honey, it sucks. It sucks that I'm away, but no buts. It sucks. Oh man, hobbies. And thank you to you guys for listening. It really does mean a lot. You know, it is weird, I'll be honest, sitting here talking into a microphone, not knowing if anyone's listening or not. But the feedback I'm getting is that you're listening. So I will sit here and continue talking into the microphone. If we're getting cool stuff, if we're ironically talking about life through a microphone, I don't know. You connect the dots. Here we go, team. That's us for another week. Enjoy your week. Hugs to everyone out there. We're signing off, I guess. See you later.
Whoa, this is my Kiwi Life.